Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 114. It's October 8th, 2020. The late, esteemed English actor Christopher Lee traced his ancestry directly to Charlemagne. In 2010, Lee released a symphonic metal album paying homage to the first Holy Roman Emperor, but his enthusiasm may have been a tad excessive. After all, says geneticist Adam Rutherford, literally everyone with European ancestry is directly descended from Charlemagne. The family tree of humanity is much more interconnected than we think. We're culturally bound and psychologically conditioned to not think about ancestry in very broad terms, Rutherford says. Genealogists can only focus on one branch of a family tree at a time, making it easy to forget how many forebears each of us has. Imagine counting all your ancestors as you trace your family tree back in time. In the nth generation before the present, your family tree has 2 to the n slots. 2 for parents, 4 for grandparents, 8 for great-grandparents, and so on. The number of slots grows exponentially. By the 33rd generation, about 800 to 1,000 years ago, you have more than 8 billion of them. That is more than the number of people alive today, and it is certainly a much larger figure than the world population millennium ago. The seeming paradox has a simple resolution. Branches of your family tree don't consistently diverge, Rutherford says. Instead, they begin to loop back into each other. As a result, many of your ancestors occupy multiple slots in your family tree. For example, your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother might have also been your great-great-great-aunt, he explains. The consequence of humanity being, quote, incredibly inbred, end quote, is that we are all related much more closely than our intuition suggests, Rutherford says. Take, for instance, the last person from whom everyone on the planet today is descended. In 2004, mathematical modeling and computer simulations by a group of statisticians led by Douglas Rohde, then at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, indicated that our most recent common ancestor probably lived no earlier than 1400 BC, and possibly as recently as AD 55. In the time of Egypt's Queen Nefertiti, someone from whom we are all descended was likely alive somewhere in the world. Go back a bit further, and you reach a date when our family trees share not just one ancestor in common, but every ancestor in common. At this date, called the genetic isopoint, the family trees of any two people on the earth now, no matter how distantly related they seem, trace back to the same set of individuals. If you were alive at the genetic isopoint, then you are the ancestor of either everyone alive today or no one alive today, Rutherford says. Humans left Africa and began dispersing throughout the world at least 120,000 years ago, but the genetic isopoint occurred much more recently, somewhere between 5300 and 2200 BC, according to Rohde's calculations. At first glance, these dates may seem much too recent to account for long isolated indigenous communities in South America and elsewhere. But genetic information spreads rapidly through generational time, Rutherford explains. Beginning in 1492, you begin to see the European genes flowing in every direction until our estimates are that there are no people in South America today who don't have European ancestry. In fact, even more recent than the global genetic isopoint is the one for people with recent European ancestry. Researchers using genomic data placed the latter date around AD 1000. So Christopher Lee's royal lineage is unexceptional because Charlemagne lived before the isopoint and has living descendants. Everyone with European ancestry is directly descended from him. In a similar vein, nearly everyone with Jewish ancestry has ancestors who were expelled from Spain beginning in 1492. It's a very nice example of a small world, but looking to the past, says Susana Manrubia, a theoretical evolutionary biologist at the Spanish National Center for Biotechnology. Okay, so I've been reading way over my head from an article called Humans Are More Closely Related Than We Commonly Think, which is in Scientific American by Scott Hershberger, and it looks to be published on October 5th, 2020. Obviously, one fun message is we're more closely related than we commonly think. All these differences and such. We just have a lot in common. And it's a small world after all theme here. Even if, by the way, I suppose some of these mathematical models and statistical analyses, again, I'm sure far over my head. I'm not qualified to assess, and maybe the state of the art in the thinking will change over time. Nonetheless, pretty cool message. Interestingly, too, it reminds me, I will find and put in the show notes, a couple things. One, there was a photo that was going around a few weeks, maybe months ago. I believe a woman who has a child survived a concentration camp. And while still living and elderly, all her living descendants assembled together, maybe in Israel. I can't remember exactly. I think that's where the photo was taken. Not 100% sure. And I want to say, you'll see in the show notes the link, but something like 110 living descendants in just that short span of time. Something like that. She had 110 living descendants standing with her. And of course, none of that happens if she dies as a child in a concentration camp. And it really, it got me thinking too about something like the United States Civil War. In the Civil War, all the battlefields, 13,000 die at Shiloh in a single day or whatever happened, Gettysburg, Pickett's Charge, all of that. Those young men dead on the battlefield, if they aren't fathers before they leave for the war, then their personal line of descendants is eliminated. That's it. And so all of us who are living, breathing right now share a certain miraculous air, do we not? By the simple act of being here right now. And what's cool in this article is how closely we are all related. And it's interesting, it's in terms of this generational clicks through time, it's simply not that many that take you back to 1492 before Europeans eject out of Europe and spread all over the place. And now we sort of have this global village, I think a Marshall McLuhan term. We've got a series of ever-advancing and intertwining technologies that have made the world sure seem smarter, instantaneous, easier than ever to travel, COVID notwithstanding, temporarily, and all such things, and the just, you know, telephones and the web and satellites and all of it. So the world since 1492 has changed dramatically and smaller than ever. And it didn't take very long for all that sort of mixing to occur. So imagine, yeah, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000 years from now, assuming that humanity can hold it together, where we might go, what we might be up to, and how much more of a mix and there will be by then in a shared common ancestry. Those isolated pools and pockets sure seem to be slowly but surely being absorbed into this amazing branching family tree. So I thought I would read this one today. I did get up early this morning. It took the alarm clock. I didn't wake up on my own. The alarm clock went off at 4:50. I'm still not particularly good at becoming productive by 5 o'clock. I kind of amble around a little bit in the early going. I did. By 5:30, I had running shoes on and was outside. I ran 4 miles, longer than the 3-miler I did in the dark the other day. And on Monday, an 18-week training window that hopefully will culminate with the Austin Marathon on Valentine's Day, and hopefully that will occur downtown, and hopefully that will occur downtown with spectators, family and friends of everybody, and just Austin, all of Austin. We'll see. The chances are maybe not great. Nonetheless, going to train looks like a handful of the other regulars will too, and so we'll be cheering each other on and holding each other accountable and that kind of thing. That'll be fun. I am not yet convinced that I'm going to keep the runs in the dark in the early morning hours. I'm going to also probably test with doing other things. You know, simple stuff, work emails and projects and writing and things while it's dark. And maybe as the sun rises or maybe a little later, getting in the runs then. We'll see how it all plays out. Got to go a little slower in the dark. It's dark. So I don't want to like trip, fall, etc. And so sidewalks or streets or whatever, it's dark. But it's fun getting up in the morning. And I am, by the way, working my way through a book I mentioned recently, The Four Disciplines of Execution. It's really cool. And it covers the basics. It's you got this nice little tight self-contained system for a group of people with shared goals to help each other execute. And I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it quite a bit. And I'd mentioned before, at a high level, you pick one, ideally one, but no more than two, wildly important goal. You focus on these lead measures, things you can do now that will advance you towards the goal. A lag measure is something you do looking in the rearview mirror, like if you're trying to get healthy, maybe what your weight is or how many push-ups you can do. If it's a company, maybe your revenue or profit or something like that. Those are lag measures. By the time you're looking at the number, all the behaviors that led to that number are baked in. They can't be changed. But a lead measure is something you can change. So you pick lead measures like, again, fitness, maybe running or exercise or diet, those kinds of things. You come up with a scoreboard that's easy to see, simple to understand, and that way the team can see your progress in real time or near real time. And then on a weekly basis, you look at it quickly and hold each other accountable. It's the simplest set of ideas in the world, which they freely admit. And it's interesting too, in all of the sort of personal productivity literature, those same ideas resonate. Even somebody like Leo Bauta, who was just getting himself in shape and writing and executing on in his own projects and things for just himself, would say the same. Like, don't try to change all your habits at once. Just focus on this one thing and knock it down. And then the next thing. In 40X, they talk about the whirlwind, their term for like all the normal chaos and usual stuff of life. Not this one goal, but you've got, you know, duties and jobs and things and emails and errands and all the stuff that happens both in your job and then outside your job. And there's a bit of freedom too. They say, look, the idea isn't to ignore all that stuff. You can't. So just, it's sort of like a concept, the idea of just maybe 20% of your time, you're going to make sure and carve out to do the activities that you measure with these lead measures that are focused on this one goal. The other 80% of the time you have to deal with the so-called whirlwind. But what's nice is, if you imagine that you achieve this wildly important goal, it could be a discrete project, successful completion of a discrete project. It could be reaching, you know, a revenue target or a fitness target or those kinds of things. But you reach that target. Well, what you're able to do as you develop and expand your capacity personally or as a group of people working together, well, you kind of fold that into the whirlwind. It just becomes part of the whirlwind going forward. And then you can set a new goal. that's just exactly congruent with Leo Babalta and many others on a personal basis. So it's really interesting. We're going to actually start using it formally at Amplifier. We'll see how it goes. And I didn't record this first thing. I recorded it. It's a little later. And I've had some hitches, kiddo and dog and whatnot. So I have to go find the time later today to drop out some stuff in the audio. And but I'll get it posted. I have to say, I really do aspire. This is still just wildly experimental and a tiny little thing that I'm doing every day just to make sure I do it every day. I'm enjoying it. The handful of people that I've told about it, I appreciate that you're listening and tell me that you are and any feedback that you have. But I do aspire to, like, it's seven in the morning and the thing's going to be there. It's occurred to me to maybe try to record one at night. It's very rare that I'm recording something that just happened overnight or something. I have to wait until the morning. I like to do one every day. I do not want to be Pat Sajak, I think, where he works like 3 days a week or something, and maybe like 3 days a week for just a small number of weeks, and then they bank all of these Wheel of Fortune episodes so they can be slowly dripped out over time. That's pretty genius. It's a game show. I kind of like the practice of doing this on a daily basis, but it's occurred to me maybe I could do them a day in advance or, you know, the night before, late afternoon before, get everything, knock out everything that I'm going to do that day at Amplifier and otherwise, and sort of late afternoon maybe knock one out. I would kind of need to earn that by having all stuff covered. The reality, though, is during work hours, like, there's phone calls and things, just the availability with other people. So maybe the evening, or maybe just do them in the morning, but a day ahead. Still doing them in the morning, but a day ahead. Because I kind of like the idea, even if there's a little wiggle in that one particular episode, it would be really interesting, I think, over time, if just at 7 in the morning, you knew it was going to be there. Today that didn't happen. So it's just kind of not as ideal. If some of you like are looking at 7 in the morning, there, some of them are super short. So maybe you're not doing that at all. You're looking every few days and catching up, or however you want to do it. It doesn't matter to me, but it's just something I'm thinking about. So as I continue to work on sort of morning routines and Darren Roberts, hopefully talking about the night routines before the morning routines, all that kind of stuff. It's on my mind. I'll get it figured out. You'll have a good one. Thanks.